America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day if you were waiting for the outcome on that Democratic right to vote bill. At least that's what they call it, a freedom to vote bill. The Democrats lost. The Freedom to Vote Act, which would have made it easier to register, would have made Election Day a public holiday, would ensure states have early voting for federal elections, and allow all voters to request mail-in ballots. Well, it lost. It went nowhere, as expected to some extent, because the vote was 49 to 51. How did that work out? Why did the Democrats put this bill up when it was virtually certain it had no chance of passage? We will get to that, but first, a fundamental question, which really does go to some of the essence of what people are going to find out determining the outcome of the election of 2024. There's a piece that appeared in Real Clear Politics. It's interesting. It's solid. It's about American history, really, and about the history of third parties. And the piece is by Andrew Bush. It's called Third Parties on the Horizon. What does history say? We're glad to welcome Andrew Bush to the show. He is a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College and the author of Divided We Stand, the 2020 Elections and American Politics. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us on the show, and congratulations on the piece.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let me go first to understanding the difference in the election of 2016, which obviously Donald Trump won, and the election of 2020, which Joe Biden won. What role did third parties play in that difference?
Well, third parties got a lot more votes in 2016 than they did in 2012. In 2020. Libertarians, for example, got about 3% of the total vote in 2020. It was more like 1%. In 2016, the Greens got about 1% of the total vote, and last year they got about 0.25%. So there was a lot less third-party voting. I'm not sure that they made that much difference overall. Hillary Clinton complained quite a bit that she thought that the Green Party candidate Jill Stein had deprived her of victory because the total of Stein's votes in the key states that put Donald Trump over the top was bigger than Trump's margin. And so Hillary Clinton sort of made the leap to saying, well, of course, these are Green voters that are on the left. If they didn't vote for Jill Stein, they would have voted for me, and I would have won. But it turns out the exit polls did not bear that out. I mean, it seems that about half of those Jill Stein voters wouldn't have voted at all. And some of them would have voted for Trump, more of them for Clinton, but not enough to actually change the result.
Yeah, what I would put forward on the table as an argument is that she, Hillary Clinton, also got lost a number of votes to the Green Party, because the Green Party was Gary Johnson and Bill Weld, and their 3%, and they had emphasized issues like marijuana. They, of course, are very pro-choice on abortion, the libertarians, and very different from, in other words, their difference on policy was not only a difference between the libertarians and Donald Trump. There was a great deal of similarity between the appeal of libertarian voters, and I think some of the exit polls show that a fair percentage of libertarian voters, and with the three times the vote they got last time. By the way, who was the libertarian candidate last time? Do you remember? You must.
Jill Jorgensen was her name.
And the question is who?
Yeah, exactly.
and again, she got one-third the vote that the libertarians got the time before. By the way, are the Libertarians planning another full-out campaign next time?
Well, I haven't read anything about that, but I would assume that they are, because they're out of all the third parties that are operating, they're the longest lasting that actually get any significant votes, and they run pretty much every year. They have in place a pretty good machine in terms of getting themselves on the ballot in every state. And running candidates every year. So I would anticipate that they would be, yeah.
But the 3% that they got in 2016 is the most ever for the Libertarians.
Right. Right.
Okay, so basically when you say third parties on the horizon, what is likely to happen with third parties next time? There's been a bunch of recent discussion by frustrated conservatives about, and including very prominent conservatives. And isn't Evan McMullen, who would run a third-party candidacy, which is basically a one-state candidacy in Utah where he got like 20%, he's planning to run against Senator Mike Lee?
Yeah, there are there's talk on sort of emanating from the bases of both of the major parties. Definitely a lot of conservatives who are disaffected. Some bolted in 2016 with Evan McMullen, and others have kind of toughed it out, hoping that once Donald Trump left the scene, things would kind of return to normal. He lost, but he hasn't really left the scene. And there is definitely an ongoing influence that he has within the Republican Party. So I think, you have Evan McMullen talking about this. You have Jonah Goldberg advocating for a third party of conservatives. And on the Democratic side, you have Andrew Yang, who was the Democratic a Democratic candidate for the nomination in 2020, and then ran for mayor of New York this year, unsuccessfully. But he has now said that he's stepping out of the Democratic Party and starting this new party that he calls the Forward Party. There are a lot of Democrats and liberals who have criticized him because they're afraid he's going to split the vote. So there's a lot of talk right now. Historically, it's not that easy to convert the talk into reality. Third parties face all sorts of obstacles, and I think back to John Anderson. You remember John Anderson, who ran?
Sure.
He was the liberal Republican congressman from Illinois, ran in the 1980 Republican primaries, lost to Ronald Reagan, and decided to run as an independent. And he actually got about 6 or 7% of the vote in the general election in 1980. And right after that, he made big noise about how he was going to start this new party, run again in 1984 with the federal money that he was able to get, the matching funds from his 1980 campaign, and it just sputtered out. It didn't wind up going anywhere, and he wound up just endorsing Walter Mondale. So it's hard to say right now. It's hard to say. I think it's clear that there's a lot of agitation out there for third parties of several varieties, but how much of that is going to actually be realized by 2024 is very hard to say.
That's Andrew Bush. His piece, which we'll post at our website at michaelmedved.com, it's one of the two-part pieces at Real Clear Politics. It's called Third Parties on the Horizon, What Does History Say? Andrew, I appreciate your coming on the show. When we come back, why did Chuck Schumer actually vote against the Democratic bill on voting rights? Yeah, that's a surprise. Not really. We'll tell you why and what it means for the future of this issue coming up on the Medved Show.
Michael Medved.
on the Michael Medved show, the Republicans have successfully blocked the latest voting rights bill. And it's extremely misleading to call this a voting rights bill. It is known as the Freedom to Vote Act, as if opposing it meant that you were trying to stop people from voting. And that's not the case at all. The final vote in the Senate was 49 to 51. It didn't get to that 51 votes they actually needed. In fact, they needed at this point to get beyond the filibuster. They needed to find 60 votes, so they didn't even really come close. Some on the left called to change the chamber's rules to allow the Democratic Party now to unilaterally change federal election law. The vote on this act was 49 to 51. It would have made it easier to vote, allegedly, by making Election Day a public holiday, ensuring states have early voting for federal elections, most of them do, and allow all voters to request mail-in ballots. Also, same-day registration. The measure would also bolster security on voting systems, would overhaul how congressional districts are redrawn to allegedly reduce the level of partisan gerrymandering. But, of course, that doesn't always work that way when the various states impose their own systems in that way. It would also impose new disclosures on donations to outside groups active in political campaigns. Axios reports that the one Democratic vote against considering this bill, and it was really a vote to even prevent it from coming up for debate at this point, the vote against that on the Democratic side was from Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. He changed his vote to nay at the vote's conclusion and entered a motion to reconsider the vote, saying, "I want to be clear about what just happened on the floor of the Senate. Every single Republican senator blocked this chamber from having a debate, simply a debate on protecting Americans' right to vote in free and fair elections." Schumer said in remarks following the vote, "The big picture, the bill included provisions to make Election Day a public holiday, have same-day voter registration, et cetera, et cetera." Look, the point about this is that it included nothing to try to establish ID for voting, which many states do not have. And this is one of those things that if they were going to change the election system on a federal basis, if they had introduced something like that, most Americans support that enthusiastically, and they might have even gotten some Republican support. But this was a partisan power grab. It had very little to do with the Freedom to Vote Act. And part of the proof of that is this bill is coming up right after we had record-breaking turnouts, where there were more people, including people of color, including minorities, including people who had never voted before, who came out to vote. We do not have a problem with, obviously, as the vote of 2020 demonstrates, with people actually coming forward and voting. They do that. And it seems to me that this is part of what is a real problem for the Biden administration, for the Democrats in Washington, which is, why push forward on something like this, where you simply are not going to get, there's no way that you can push forward unless you drop the filibuster. And both Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin and potentially some other Democratic senators are not willing to get rid of the filibuster in order to get this one bill passed. And so what are they doing? Just harping on this as a means of trying to gather or build support. There's something else that I think that the Democrats are completely out of line with, and Democratic-aligned groups are out of line with public opinion. And that has to do with all of the debate that has been going on about Dave Chappelle. Okay, his comedy special, The Closer, premiered on October 5th. And in the special, the number one comedian in the world, and by any measure, he is that, critiqued woke culture and hit particularly hard at some of the excesses of the LGBTQ plus community and whatever else you want to add to that alphabet soup. And he hit some sacrosanct ideas. And the fact that he is refusing to back down under enormous pressure, they're planning coming up a walkout of employees, as particularly gay, lesbians, bisexual, and transgendered employees at Netflix. And yes, they have a bunch of them. They're going to walk out unless Netflix stops airing this special, which is still gathering popularity above the 10 million people who've already seen it on Netflix. During his 70 minutes on stage, Chappelle doubles down on his critique of some of the excesses in the culture today involving gender, sex, pronouns, and much more. Now, for people who haven't seen it, it's a vulgar comedy special. There are all kinds of crass and inappropriate things and not for family audiences. But some of it really puts forward moments of real truth and courage. Listen, this is 14A. And where Dave Chappelle speaks up for J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter fame. Listen.
And they've canceled people that are more powerful than me. They canceled J.K. Rowling. My God, J.K. Rowling wrote all the Harry Potter books by herself. She sold so many books, the Bible worries about her. And they canceled her because she said in an interview, and this is not exactly what she said, but effectually, she said gender was a fact. And then the trans community got mad as they started calling her a TERF. I didn't even know what that was. But I know that trans people make up words to win arguments. So I looked it up. TERF is an acronym. It stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. This is a real thing. This is a group of women that hate transgender. They don't hate transgender women, but they look at trans women the way we blacks might look at blackface. It offends them. Like, ooh, this is doing an impression of me. Now, I shouldn't speak on this because I am not a woman, nor am I a trans. But as we've established, I am a feminist. That's right. I'm Team TERF. I agree, man.
And no, he's not willing to retreat on any of this, and that's encouraging. I mean, it has to be encouraging. We'll provide some more of Dave Chappelle and some more encouraging news on the culture war front and his refusal to allow himself to be canceled. It's kind of heroic, actually. We'll get to that. We'll also talk about a non-heroic performance by the State of Washington Employment Security Department. How? Coming up with the Washington Policy Center on the MedVet Show. Michael Medved show, there is more news on something that's going to impact just about everybody who lives in the state of Washington, which is that we have still no answer on what they are allowing and how they're going to operate the so-called opt-out provision of the new Employment Security Department long-term care opt-out program. As of January 1st of next year, so a couple of weeks from now, really, there is a new 0.58%, that's 58 cents for $100, that you're going to be paying in payroll tax that you're going to need to be aware of. So that if you earn more than $100 a year, and I hope you do, it could actually make a difference to you. Elizabeth Hovde, who is the director of the Centers for Worker Rights and Healthcare for the Washington Policy Center, got the very latest here. Okay, Elizabeth, am I right that there are many, many people in the state of Washington who either don't know anything about what's about to happen to them or are confused about it?
I would say that's correct. Every day I'm getting emails or calls from people who have heard about it now, but they're too late to do anything about any option that remained, or they're confused about how to apply, or it's not letting them apply, or they don't understand how to apply. So it's a boondoggle.
Okay, just for sake of argument, if let's say you're kind of in the middle here in the state of Washington, let's say you earn family income of $65,000 a year, how much extra would that cost you?
Well, it's 58 cents per $100 of income. So the numbers I know to rattle off are if you make $50,000 a year, it's $290 that you'll contribute a year. If you make $100,000, it's $580 a year. And, of course, it goes up and it goes down. So if you're making $25,000, it's $145 a year.
So even if you're earning only $25,000 a year, that's something that you will feel and probably will notice. And what do you get in return for putting that money in right now?
Well, that's the problem. You might not get anything. This is a very one-for-all kind of program. So it is not built to ensure that you get a benefit, which is what insurance does. So marketing this as an insurance for your long-term care needs is completely inaccurate. This is a program that if you pay into for all of your working years and you have vested with 10 years paying into this thing, you can receive a $36,500 benefit at the end of the day if you need long-term care, if you live in the state still, and if you meet the vestment criteria and other provisions of needing care.
So let's say you've decided you're going to retire to Florida, say, and you've been paying in for 10 years. Do you have any benefit left over from what you're paying in if you no longer live in the state of Washington?
No, the benefit is not portable right now. So the way the law is written, if you move out of the state in your retirement years, as many people do, to go find sun somewhere, you do not receive the benefit that you've been promised for paying in all those years. Also, if you are a Washington worker, but you live right now in Idaho or Oregon, you don't get the benefit at the end of the day unless you move into Washington State. So these are glaringly unfair provisions that make people want out of this tax.
Do you have, I mean, you're immersed in this, and I so much appreciate your clarity because, again, it's extremely confusing to me. I don't think I could explain it to people. What was the core motivation for the Democrats, and it was all Democrats, who pushed this through the legislature?
It comes from a good place. 7 of 10 of us, Health and Human Services says, we'll need long-term care at some point in our lives, and people aren't prioritizing saving for it, et cetera. And instead of talking to people about making priorities and understanding that this is a real need for so many people later in life, they've told you how you're going to save for long-term care. Some of us have assets that we're going to use. Some of us have family options that are available to us. And the people who supported this law wanted to protect the state by making Medicaid cost less for the state. So the Medicaid payouts for long-term care were rising, and the people who supported this law knew they needed to do something to rein it in. So they decided to cost shift, as I call it, onto people who are working today to pay those Medicaid dollars that they've made available to people
for
long-term care.
Let me ask you this, because when you talk about a lifetime benefit for long-term care, there are an awful lot of people who are going to need a lifetime benefit bigger than $36,500, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, if you look at the Genworth cost of care survey, you can see that this is something that will last about 3 months in assisted living in Washington State. And the state will come back and they'll say, well, this isn't really meant for that. This is meant for home care, you know, having someone come into your house a few times a week or more so. And that, then it can last you a year. But that's not how most people think of long-term care. That's helping mom with some of her errands.
No, I just want to make clear to people what you're just hearing, which is very, very important. You're talking about paying in for 10 years, and that paying in for 10 years will cover you for about 3 months or at best a year with your home care, or one year with your assisted living, or 3 years with your home care. Is that right?
Well, 3 months
for
nursing home care.
Paying 10 years in for 3 months. Good deal.
Right. And you know, the real thing here that I've seen the state doing in their webinars about this, now that they're finally talking about the fact that they're going to have this new payroll tax, is they're making this a comparison between private long-term care insurance and the state's proposed program. And really, that's not the only option. A lot of us have other things we're doing to plan for these needs later in life. And part of that is our income helps us get to those places. And now they're going to be taking our income and minimizing our family budgets. I just think it's horribly misguided.
I think that there are a lot of people who are hearing from us who are going to want absolutely to get more information. They can get that information from the Washington Policy Center. And Elizabeth Hovde is running the operation that can provide that information to you. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the banner for Washington Policy Center, and benefit from and support this outstanding resource. You can go directly to them. At Washington Policy Center or WashingtonPolicy.org, or simply go to the banner at MichaelMedved.com. When we come back, there is more with some news about the FBI finding human remains, which might be those of Brian Laundrie. This unbelievably heavily publicized case of Gabby Pepito, who is a murder victim. Now they may have found her former boyfriend. We'll get to that on The Medved Show. Michael Medved Show, there is a great opportunity for you to take advantage of a very low price on a very valuable service. The price is 22 cents a day. It comes to $79 per year. But that gives you access every single day to download a live broadcast of our show, or a broadcast of our show at any time, or any piece of our show, or any part that you want, all commercial free. And then also, and even more importantly, to access everything we have in our MedVed History Store. Some 80 different titles of history programs about all of the most controversial issues in American history. About the founding of this country, about the true story of the Pilgrims and Thanksgiving coming up, which is one of our most popular history programs and is a needed corrective for all of the politically correct 1619 Project style material that you're going to be deluged with. Become a MedHead member. because as a MedHead member, and again, 22 cents a day, you can download as much material as you want and engage it. And just go to michaelmedved.com, that's michaelmedved.com, or go to medvedhistorystore.com and become a MedHead. It's a new membership option available still for a while longer for an introductory offer for a MedHead membership of 20% off. Join today. Go to michaelmedved.com. Okay, there is this. I mean, the FBI has announced that investigators found human remains and a backpack and some other belongings belonging to Brian Laundry. They have not been able to confirm as yet that the remains are Laundry. It says the remains have been there for some time, and the FBI will be there for some time to try to find out what happened. But I hope that this will allow us to hear a little bit less about this case. I'm a little bit surprised, frankly, about the level of fascination here, and I don't fully understand it. I mean, it's a terribly sad case. And yes, these were two nice-looking people, and they were having their dream vacation, and I'm sure there's a story, a backstory of abuse and horror and brutal murder. And you can see they're already writing the TV movie, right? And they don't even know exactly what happened. But maybe there are some people who've been very concerned about Gabby Pepito and who will now sleep better at night with the idea that this appears it may have been a murder-suicide of some kind. That is purely speculation. We will bring you the rest when it's definitive. There is also a tweet of the day.
Turn the page now to the internet.
I mean, wow, what a great, smart tweet.
Change his password so he no longer has access to his Twitter feed.
Did you send the tweet?
I did not send that tweet. My system was hacked. I was pranked.
Donald Trump hasn't tweeted at us once, and I'm starting to get worried about him.
So we have a new tweet.
All right.
Can I do the honors?
Stand by. Tweet alert.
And this is actually a very clever tweet by Marco Rubio, who's retweeting something else. And Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, tweets, this is what the people in charge of our nation's foreign policy are working on today. And they have sent out from the State Department the following tweet that he retweets. Today, on International Pronouns Day, we share why many people list pronouns on their email and social media profiles. Read more here on shareamerica.go.usa.gov.mzhx. International Pronouns Day occurs on the third Wednesday of October. Okay, that would be today. The goal of this day is to make respecting, sharing, and educating about personal pronouns commonplace in both personal and professional environments. Oh, please. And then on the bottom, they say that they show a number of figures who are all dressed in different colors, and they're of different races. One is wearing a turban, and they have she, her, he, him, they, them, he, him. They, them, and she, her. Well, wonderful. ShareAmerica.gov. Why do many Americans list pronouns on social media profiles? It's a question for the ages. Read on to learn why it matters what pronouns you use to refer to people and how the United States embraces sharing pronouns. Okay, this is our government speaking for you. This is one of the reasons that Dave Chappelle, who we mentioned before, is so enormously popular and has gotten such a terrific response for his special, The Closer. And of course, we'll hear more about this when they do a major walkout at Netflix and they want Netflix to apologize and to end it. And I don't think they're going to work because people enjoy hearing what Dave Chappelle has to say. For instance, he commented on the fact that there was a surprise winner this year for Woman of the Year. This is clip 14B.
Gender is a fact. You have to look at it from a woman's perspective. Look at it like this. Caitlyn Jenner, whom I've met, wonderful person. Caitlyn Jenner was voted Woman of the Year. Her first year as a woman. Ain't that something? Beat every in Detroit, she's better than all of you. Never even had a period. Ain't that something? Oh, I'd be mad if I was a woman. I'd be mad if I was me. If I was in a BET Awards sitting there and they're like, and the winner for of the year, Eminem, my man. Gender is a fact. This is a fact. Every human being in this room, every human being on Earth, had to pass through the legs of a woman to be on Earth. That is a fact.
Okay, and then the most controversial aspect of what he said was this. I think we have just barely time for it. It's a clip 13.
But, you know, a lot of the LGBTQ community doesn't know the baby's history. He's a wild guy. He once shot and killed him in Walmart. Oh, this is true. Google it. The baby shot and killed in Walmart in North
this
Carolina.
Is a rapper.
The Nothing bad happened rapper. To his career. Do you see where I'm going with this? In our country, you can shoot and kill a but you better not hurt a gay person's feelings.
That's Dave Chappelle. And look, the entire thing helps to put in context some of the issues of political correctness in our society and woke culture. Coming back, maybe an indication of how you cope with all of this. There's a piece that ran in the New York Times. It's inspired tremendous controversy. It basically argues that college degrees are overrated. Does this mean buyer's remorse for some of the people who spend a phenomenal amount of money to get college degrees for themselves or for their relatives? We'll also talk about the lawsuit of the day, or maybe of the year. Basically, as people made clear yesterday, Nick Rolovich, the former coach of the Washington State University Cougars, fired himself by refusing to explain why he was refusing to get a vaccine and refusing to get a vaccine. Now he has launched a lawsuit against the university itself, and a lawsuit for wrongful termination. How will that go? We will cover that as well. We will also be speaking about another athlete from the world of football, very prominent one, who decried cancel culture. And Charles Barkley, another sports figure, takes a dramatic opportunity and a dramatic stand against a very controversial issue. And Brett Stevens writes about why Colin Powell gave America a missed opportunity. Brett Stevens thinks they should have been president. We'll deal with that and more in this greatest nation on God's green earth.